Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do we take up arms against enemies overseas? Most adults recognize that any war is likely to result in human casualties and financial strains and long-term complications on both sides of the conflict. And in addition to the potential hardships, war represents a moral dilemma for a population as broadly religious as that of the United States. And as my guest today will explain, it is precisely because we are such a devout nation that we have always sought justification for our actions. But he argues we don't hold such justifications up to the proper scrutiny before following our leaders into battle. Richard E. Rubenstein is professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. His new book is called Reasons to Kill: Why Americans Choose War. Rich, welcome to Think.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
So we have now entered our 10th consecutive year of war, and yet most of us in this country do not think of ourselves as inherently bellicose. Can you talk about the disconnect?
Yeah, it is a strange disconnect, because we have a record of war making which is really unsurpassed, you know, by anybody else in the world, and we certainly don't think of ourselves generally as bellicose. We think of ourselves as people who go to war very reluctantly and only for good reasons. So that even with Americans, some of the kinds of appeals to people to go to war that have been successful in other cultures or in other countries that, they used to tell the British that they had to go to war to defend their empire. And Americans are never told that they even have an empire, much less that they ought to defend it. Hmm. Other nations have gone to war because people were told it was in the national interest, or they needed territory, or they needed some natural resource. With Americans, who, as you said rightly, are a religious people, the wars have to be justified traditionally on grounds of moral necessity. For example, that the war is necessary in self-defense, which is considered a sacred right, or that the war is justified because of our humanitarian duty, or because there's some evil enemy that will wreak havoc throughout the world if we don't stop him. There's always a powerful moral reason justified by our civil religion that lies behind the appeal to go to war. And every once in a while, those appeals are valid. But in an awful lot of cases, they are not valid. And then we get the impression that we have not been critical enough when we've been asked to go to war, just as you said at the beginning of the hour. Things have gotten worse lately, it seems to me, because now that many people are being induced to accept a state of kind of permanent war as normal, there are powerful pressures being brought upon us to not ask, to not demand that the war be morally justified, so that we have a very strange situation at the moment when you consider Afghanistan, for example, in which most people disapprove of the war. Most people don't think that it's justified. And yet the disapproval is expressed in a very kind of passive way, which allows the war to continue.
So who benefits from talking us into this?
Well, there are lots of people who benefit. And one of the arguments I make in my book is that I'm not really asking Americans to become more peace-loving. I think most of them love peace quite well. I'm asking them to become more hard-headed and to ask questions when these arguments for war and images also associated with the arguments are brought up, to ask questions like the one you just asked. Whose interest is this war actually being fought? We went to war against Spain to liberate Cuba from Spain in 1898. And there was no talk about anybody's interest. In fact, most Americans were in favor of that war because the Spanish were doing such horrible things to the Cuban independence movement. Just atrocious. So we went to war and we liberated Cuba from Spain. And then the next thing you know, we also liberated some other territories, such as the Philippines. Well, the next thing you know, first of all, we really wouldn't let Cuba become independent. We decided we were going to control Cuba. And that's the first that we began to hear about Cuban sugar and Cuban tobacco and Cuban farmland for cattle and the possibility of oil and Cuban, etc. Right away, we, you know, immediately the question was, what do we do with Spain now that we've conquered it? And the answer, which President McKinley said came to him in a kind of vision in the White House, was to hold on to Spain and Christianize it. Kind of funny thing to say since they were already Catholic. But the result of that, which was absolutely horrible, was a war of an insurgency against America, which the Americans put down between 1900 and 1902, using the same techniques exactly that the Spanish had used against the Cubans. Ghastly techniques, including, by the way, waterboarding is one of the techniques, torturing insurgents for information. So the question then arises of a peculiar disconnect between the high-flown moral reasons that are given to getting us into wars and the interests, private interests, and sometimes public interests in a narrow sense, governmental interests, which are served by going to war. So I suppose the most dramatic recent example is Iraq, in which we allegedly went to war to get rid of a terrible dictator who had weapons of mass destruction and was allied with terrorists. It turns out he didn't. He was a terrible dictator, all right, but he had no weapons of mass destruction. He was not allied with terrorists. And the O word was never uttered in connection with that, except by the anti-war movement. Oil, the word oil, what did oil have to do with it? Well, oil had something to do with it because a U.S. government official at the time of the first Gulf War, a high government official, said about Kuwait, if they grew carrots over there, he said, we wouldn't care who owned the territory. But they don't grow carrots, they grow oil. And now we see the same sort of thing involved with Afghanistan. And the interests are of two or three types, the private interests. Or shall I say the narrow interest. One type is what I've just said, is natural resources that American companies want to get hold of. In Afghanistan, that's the minerals under the Afghan soil, which have been estimated to be worth at least $1 trillion.
Although that was a relatively recent discovery, wasn't it?
It was, but, well, it was a relatively recent discovery for the public. But you don't think that the companies that are scouting all over the world and using very high-tech methods of finding out what's under the soil, that they had no idea that there were minerals in Afghanistan. No. They already knew that they were already looking at Afghanistan as the site for a pipeline, you know, the Unocal pipeline. And I have it on good authority that there was more than a strong suspicion that there were riches under the soil. But it wasn't just that either. There's usually the second kind of interest involved too, which is a kind of geopolitical interest that involves high political officials, involves the military establishment, and involves therefore the military industrial companies. So one of the great prizes in Afghanistan has been the Bagram Air Base, an enormous air base on the Chinese border, close to the Chinese border, which many people in Washington believe was one of the primary motives, at least of some interests, in getting involved in Afghanistan. Then there's also something else. There's this kind of general geopolitical ambitions on the part of geopolitically ambitious people. People who know that what we've got here is an empire and want to extend it. So, you know, I think the main thing I'm trying to emphasize in my book at the call for is not one particular policy even or another, but a conversation that we're not having. When people say, let's go to war in Afghanistan, and then they say, we need to do that because otherwise al-Qaeda will use that country as a base against us. They used to have training camps there, and they'll come back and do that again. And the obvious answer to that has been, well, Al-Qaeda's, you know, they've left town. They're in Pakistan now, or they're in Yemen, or they're in Somalia, wherever they are. They have no need for Afghanistan. In fact, they had no need for Afghanistan to mount the attacks of 9/11 against us. Those were cooked up in Hamburg and places like in Europe. So furthermore, if the Taliban say, which they are saying, that they, if we get out of there, they will not let the Al-Qaeda come back, and that's an undertaking that can be policed. What are we doing there? Well, I want people to say that to the government. I want people to say, look, we know that there are private companies and government agencies that have interests in fighting the what Dexter Filkins calls the forever war, in fighting permanently to advance their interests around the world. But those aren't everybody's interests. So explain to us, justify to this, how you can, why this is also in our interest. Now, maybe they can justify certain things, and maybe they can convince people. But if the question isn't asked, and if it isn't asked in the skeptical kind of American way, I'm from Missouri, show me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we Americans won't give money to charity unless we know where the money's going, and unless we have a pretty good idea that it's going to go to the people who should get it. But when it comes to going to war, we give our sons and daughters and sweethearts, we give our people to the military. Of course, it helps that they need the jobs, and there are so few jobs in some parts of the country that's pressing people into service also. But leaving that aside, we sort of drop our usual hard-headed skepticism when it comes to when somebody says it's your patriotic duty to do this. And that's what I hope will stop. That is to say, I hope we will try to be as clear-headed about matters of war and peace as we are about what kind of car we're going to buy.
Why don't we think of patriotic duty as extending to efforts toward diplomacy, to solve problems that way, as much as we do think that it's our obligation, if we love our country, to stand up and fight when we're called upon to do so?
I don't know. You know, it's a very good question. Patriotism means you love your country. It means you love the place you live. It means you love many of the people. It means you love certain of its institutions. And it never has meant that you love everything there is about your country. Everybody knows that that patriotism, in a way, is selective. That love of country is selective. And if it becomes the problem is, I think, that it has a tendency to become mystical. That is to say, it has a tendency to become a kind of religion, which some religious people have recognized is really a form of idolatry if it goes too far. If it goes to the point where you are supposed to be loyal to kind of the mystical body of the nation, you know, and if it goes to the point where you're supposed to fight on command without thinking, if it goes to the point where you're supposed to love everything about America, my country right or wrong, it becomes a kind of idolatry which really cuts against the grain of most of the traditional religions as well as the grain of secular liberalism.
Richard E. Rubenstein is my guest. He's professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. We're talking this hour about his new book, Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard E. Rubenstein. He's professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. His new book is called Reasons to Kill: Why Americans Choose War. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Rich, what I think is really interesting about the two conflicts that you highlighted at the beginning of the hour, the one with Spain at the turn of the 20th century and the ones that we're having right now, is that with Spain, it sounds as if we got into it with noble intentions in Cuba and really didn't re-examine the righteousness of our actions as things started to change in the Philippines. On the other hand, when you look at the conflict in Iraq in particular, we went in saying this is about self-defense, it's about weapons of mass destruction and the threats to us. And then when those turned out to not really exist, at least the way we talked about justification changed entirely to the importance of liberty for the Iraqi people. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. One of the kinds of arguments that's traditionally been made to get Americans involved in war is the liberty argument, or is the idea that there is there's the need for a moral crusade. And the argument is really there's a connection with self-defense. Let me explain. Self-defense, when self-defense is used, as it was in Iraq at the beginning, and as it has been in almost every war in which the United States has been involved, even the Mexican War, the Mexican-American War, which is kind of obviously cooked up, a war that we cooked up in order to seize the West, even there self-defense was used as an excuse. But the self-defense has changed its meaning over the years. And the problem, the thing that people need to ask when the self-defense claim is made, is what is the self exactly that's being threatened? What exactly is the threat to us? And how real is it? If Americans on American soil are being threatened by some enemy that's trying to do them in, and that's one thing. But fairly early in our history, that was extended to where the self that to be defended actually became American ideas rather than American people and property. Hmm. So that in Cuba, of course, liberty was involved as when we first initially went in there before the whole thing kind of got corrupted. But in World War I, which is still taught in a lot of our schools, I suppose, maybe in most of our schools, it's taught as a necessary war. I think it was neither necessary nor just. The claim was made that the Kaiser of Germany, Kaiser Bill, who until fairly recently before World War I had been considered more of a kind of figure of fun or a bumbler, a kind of fool, not a threat to America, that he was actually planning to conquer the world, that if Germany and Austria, the Central Powers, defeated England and France, the next thing you know, they would be over here trying to dictate to Americans. Well, and I reproduce in my book a wonderful poster of the Hun, the German Hun, pictured as a kind of ape, with a German helmet and a club in one hand and a woman thrown over his shoulder, the kind of ape rapist kind of evil enemy image. The evil enemy, when we go for that, is always pictured as someone who wants to conquer us, to take over the entire world, always as a kind of Hitler. I mean, I think you can say that Hitler was quite interested in taking over the entire world, making the whole world fascist. But the Kaiser was not interested in making the whole world German. He was interested in having Germany join the rather select small group of great empires, of imperial powers. And that war was a war fought for territory, for wealth, for prestige, for all kinds of reasons between European powers. And frankly, I think the only reason really the Americans, Woodrow Wilson was elected in 1916 as a peace candidate, and less than 9 months later, he has committed America to a war in which more than 100,000 of our people died. in order to keep Germany from defeating Italy. Well, but why? I mean, there really was no good reason at all. I think that part of the reason was that American investment banks and American banking community in general was deeply invested in Britain and France, and if they had lost the war, it might have caused an economic crisis, at least for them. So as soon as you get the extension of self-defense to kind of preventing Kaiser Bill from taking over New York, you realize you're kind of living in fantasy land, and you're setting the stage for arguments based on a moral crusade against an evil enemy who, if we don't stop him, will take over the world. Now, as true as that might have been of Adolf Hitler, it's not true of Osama bin Laden either. I mean, there are lots of reasons to oppose Osama bin Laden, and there are lots of reasons to try to catch him and bring him to justice and so forth. But one of the reasons is not that he plans to take over the United States or that he's going to make us all become Muslims.
Well, what about that? Because we have been attacked on our own soil, but we have never been, if you leave out the years that we were fighting the American Revolution, we have not been occupied. Why are we so afraid of this thing that has never yet happened to us?
You know, it's a very good question, because you get a paradox here, and the paradox is that the most powerful country, not only in the world now, but probably in world history, which is us. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a time when any one nation so outclassed the rest of the world in terms of military power as we do, even more than Rome, you know. And why are we so afraid? What are we afraid of exactly? I think that I don't want to play psychoanalyst here, but I think there are certain kinds of internal fears that we have that we tend to externalize. One suspicious thing that we do, psychologically suspicious, is that we kind of pretend that we're better than anybody else, that we're morally superior.
American exceptionalism.
Yeah, American exceptionalism, but moral exceptionalism, so that, you know, you wonder if in the Spanish-American War we said we were liberating Cuba, we ended up with, you know, dominating the Philippines at an enormous cost in lives, or et cetera, down to the present time, when we say we're just liberators, but actually we become occupiers. We say we have no material interest, but actually we do have material interest. We say we're not an empire, but we are. What's the cause of that peculiar denial? And I think partly there's a suspicion that we're really not better than anybody else. That is to say, this is maybe we're just another nation in a world of nations with our virtues and our vices, the way other peoples have their virtues and vices. But to admit that we were on the same level, really, as all the other nations and peoples in the world would be to say that we're going to have to learn to live as one member of a world community with other members on terms of equality. And we're not going to be able to lord it over other people, and we're not going to be able to justify our privileges in this world in the same way that maybe we have in the past. This is one issue. Second issue, it seems to me, is that war gives you the opportunity to deny and export your internal problems so that if you've really got serious divisions in your country, if you have serious doubts about whether you're going in the right direction or not, and if you have worries about increasing diversity in your own society, it's a temptation to use war as a way of trying to unite your people, to say we're all in this together. We're all one big ethnic group.
Does it work?
We're all one religious group. Well, you know, it doesn't work. I mean, it works. It actually, if in fact social development is moving in the direction of integrating your society anyway, you know, then maybe war helps and continue that movement in that direction. But mostly, it creates divisions. If you think about what happened in Vietnam as an example. That we were at the end of the Korean War, which was a very unpopular war, so unpopular that you know, both President Eisenhower and his opponent Adlai Stevenson had to promise to end it, as they were both promising to end it if they were elected president in the 50s. Even though that war was very unpopular, it wasn't used to unite the American people, and it didn't divide the American people. There was no campaign of internal purification let me come around closer to the present. What happens in Vietnam, in the case of Vietnam War, is that that adventure is undertaken by President Johnson at a time when social divisions were sharpening in America, when America had experienced two decades of enormous economic growth, and the economic growth had raised the expectations of all kinds of groups that they would get more of their place in the sun and their share of the national pie. So you had a civil rights movement starting, you had a youth movement starting, you had a sexual revolution underway, and you had changes in family relations, you had, the new lines of social division appearing in America, and the war was kind of promoted as a way of getting everybody together behind the flag to do the right thing in Vietnam, to keep the communists from taking over South Vietnam. Well, it had exactly the opposite effect. And one reason, I think, is because that was one of the instances in which people who opposed the war included large numbers of young people who had who were developing a whole new self-image, a whole new set of expectations about the kinds of lives that they wanted to live. Not just lives of empty pleasure, by the way, but lives of moral significance. And it was the moral ambitions of young people at that time, as well as any other reason, that led them to oppose a war that just, at the bottom line, seemed it could not be justified. You know, for the first few years, this is typical of our country too. For the first few years of almost any war, people supported. Even in the case of Iraq, even when the weapons of mass destruction were not found, people still initially supported the war. But, and this was certainly true in Vietnam, where the war was supported massively for the first few years. But then people begin to look into it and to ask the kind of more hard-headed and skeptical questions, as well as the kind of, as well as moral questions about the war. What role are we playing there? Are we actually liberating people or not? In the case of Vietnam, are we just stepping into the shoes of the French, who had run that country as their own private plantation for years and years? And what about our allies? Are our allies actually interested in freedom, or are they interested in simply in their own power and privileges? Is the country that we're trying to help so corrupt that out of every dollar we give them, they 70 or 80 or 90 cents goes into somebody's pocket? All of these things, the strange thing about it, I guess, is a kind of peculiar amnesia that we have. We don't realize that the same objections that are being made to Afghanistan now on the basis of and to Iraq as well, on the basis of the venality of our allies, their unwillingness to fight for themselves, their incredible high level of corruption, etc., were all made in Vietnam. This is Afghanistan is Vietnam redux.
Let's go to the
yeah.
We're going to go to the phones now. We have lots of people who want to respond.
Sure.
First, we have Skip in Highland Village. Hi, Skip.
Oh, well, good afternoon. I think my question, you all have been talking, I've sort of moved past what I was going to ask, so let me see if I can rephrase it, is that it seems to me that war is one of the many options we have in this country. We tend to go through our toolbox of possible choices. And a lot of times, war ends up being the last the last option is, I mean, there are, we do pursue negotiations, we pursue other ways of international relations, but lots of times aggressiveness or irreconcilable differences, I guess for lack of a better word, make us go to war.
You know what? I wish that were true. I mean, I know it's what people say, and I know we would like to think that of ourselves. You know, we'd like to think that we only go to war except as a last resort. Only mainly it's not true. And let me tell you, there are two ways in which it's not true. First of all, as far as negotiations go, sometimes we try to negotiate, and lots of times we don't. You know that in the case of the first Gulf War, you know, where Saddam Hussein went into Kuwait, which he should not have done, he may have actually in some ways been lured there, by the way, by American officials, that's another story. Once he got in there, he's got his army in Kuwait, and the United States says, get out. And first thing he says is, well, let's negotiate. I'll leave under certain conditions. And the United States says, no conditions. He said, well, these very tiny conditions. He begins to look just for a face saver, and the United States says, no, we don't negotiate. Then he says, look, okay, I'll just take my army out of Kuwait then, no conditions, okay? And George Bush the First says, tell him we'll see him in Baghdad. In other words, that was not about a negotiation or a possible negotiation at all. It was about the decision that was made to destroy the Iraqi army. At that point, Bush wanted the war, and he said why. He said he wanted to eliminate the Vietnam syndrome. He wanted to make it clear that we would go to war when we decided to go to war. All Saddam Hussein wanted to do at that point was leave the country with his army, and we didn't want him to have his army anymore. So we said, no, no deal. So sometimes we don't negotiate at all. Other times we do negotiate, but we don't use conflict resolution. And that's a point which is not very well understood, which I'd like to tell you a little more about when we have some more time. But conflict resolution means eliminating the causes of the conflict, not just bargaining about it.
Well, we will talk more about that after this break. Richard E. Rubenstein is my guest. He's professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. His new book is called Reasons to Kill: Why Americans Choose War.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard E. Rubenstein, professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. His new book is Reasons to Kill: Why Americans Choose War. So, Rich, I want to talk about conflict resolution here because I think anyone would acknowledge that negotiating with heads of state, even those as despotic as we believe Saddam Hussein to have been, is one thing. But considering the grievances of terrorists is quite another. It feels like negotiating with terrorists. Can you talk about how we can use conflict resolution and diplomacy to avoid war, given the realities of 21st century conflict?
Sure. There's been a lot of literature now, new literature, which I don't talk about in my book, about negotiating with terrorists. Let me make this first distinction between negotiating and conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. Negotiating usually means people sit down at a table and they don't point weapons at each other, you know, but they put the weapons under the table or behind their backs, and they bargain, and they bargain from strength. And the bargaining is, I want this, and no, you can't have that, we'll only give you half of that, and no, but we want three quarters and so forth. It's like a commercial negotiation, but it's about power instead of money. Sometimes it's about money, too. Well, there's a whole other model of interaction between people in conflict, and the other model is people sit down and they say to each other, usually with some facilitation, somebody to help, They say, what's going on here? I mean, how did this, you know, the question Marlon Brando asked on The Godfather, how did we get to this place where we're killing each other? What's actually behind the conflict? And what do we actually need? Not so much, not just what interests do we claim to be defending, but what human needs are not being satisfied on both sides that are driving us into this conflict. Now, if you do conflict resolution, it's something interesting tends to happen. It was the secret of success, really, in Northern Ireland and finally making peace between the Protestants and Catholics. It was the secret of success in Macedonia, in many other countries, after the Soviet Empire vanished, especially. It's been used in Africa. It's been used in very, very successfully and by the director of my institute, the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution, used it in Mozambique to help settle the Mozambique Civil War. Because this is not just about bargaining for some kind of truce. This is about trying to rebuild community on the basis of a common understanding of what's gone wrong in the community. So now let me answer your question. As far as bargaining with terrorists is concerned, I wouldn't bargain with them either. As far as doing conflict resolution is concerned, you can absolutely do it. You don't necessarily go to Osama bin Laden, you know, who's on your most wanted list, and say, let's sit down and talk. But in the case of extreme Islamists of the al-Qaeda type, you say, we want to meet with you with some facilitator who we both trust to help us with this discussion and talk about what's poisoned the relationship between the West and the Islamic world. We want to talk about, you know, we heard Osama bin Laden say that he didn't want American troops on the sacred soil of Saudi Arabia, even though these folks had taken U.S. aid when they were in Afghanistan fighting against the Russians. And he wanted us out of Saudi Arabia. You were objecting to what we were doing in Iraq. You were objecting to how we were playing the game in the Middle East and in Israel and Palestine. Let's start talking about that. We know that there are people in the Islamic world, not all of them, but some of them, substantial numbers of people who are greatly offended by all sorts of things that we're doing over there, ranging from the kinds of leaders we support to the way that we support them, which sometimes amounts to straight bribery, to the kinds of products we're trying to sell people, which some people over there consider immoral, etc. Let's talk about all that. Why pretend that there are no real differences between these communities and that the only differences are that, as President Bush II said, they hate us for our freedom? Well, that's just nonsense. Their main enemy, the Islamist terrorists, whether they're in Somalia or Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever they are, you know, their main enemy is the near enemy. What they call the near enemy. Their main enemy are local forces allied very often with us who are doing things in their society that they consider illegal, immoral, contrary to the interests of the poor, contrary to the interests of national development. Those are things that can be discussed because some of those charges may be correct. And if we can deal with that and if we can face the fact that there are people operating in our name around the world who are doing things that ultimately that are making us less secure, then maybe we can get somewhere in dealing with the causes of terrorism. And that's not, you know, that's not, to my way of thinking, negotiating with terrorists. It is talking with them, and it is taking another look at how your own behavior may be contributing to the problem.
Rich, given the realities of the media and the state of political discourse in this country in 2010, if the Department of State were to decide to engage in this sort of thing, would it have to happen in secret?
You know, probably yes. And very often that's the way these things happen. At first, they happen in secret. And then leaders who really want to lead can prepare people for a change in policy that, because that is in their interest, can help to convince people that by following a different policy, they'll be more safer and more secure and more prosperous and so on. And, you know, I mean, there's precedent for this, and that isn't during the Cold War. There were negotiations with Russia taking place in secret. I mean, during the Vietnam War, there were actually also secret negotiations taking place between the parties to that conflict. But I think the most dramatic example are the Russian negotiations, which took place for a long time in secret, and then they took place in the form of citizen diplomacy, which is a very interesting way to do this. You don't necessarily have to have governments start these conversations. In the case of the Cold War, there was a group of public-spirited citizens from both sides, from the Russian and the American sides, that met in New Hampshire, in a place that was called the Pugwash Conference. And they held discussions about nuclear disarmament years before nuclear disarmament became a reality, but not many years before. In the case of South Africa and that terrible racial conflict caused by apartheid down there, there were secret discussions taking place between the representatives of the government or people close to the government and representatives of the African National Congress for years before Mandela was freed and things started to move more rapidly towards peace. Several of my colleagues at my institute are involved in talks, some confidential and some not confidential, in places like Georgia and Jordan, not the state, the country, in places like Syria and places like Indonesia, places where there's some heavy-duty conflict. And they're functioning as private, totally private and independent facilitators. They're not working for the U.S. government. I don't think they should work for the U.S. government. I think it's very important that independent people should be able to facilitate these kinds of conversations. And the people who participate in the conversations aren't top government officials very often either. They are people who are influential in their communities and people who have the ear of the government officials. And that often is the way, you know, peace gets made, beginning with citizen initiatives and beginning with private initiatives and then finally resulting in what they call track one diplomacy, you know, between governments.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, following George W. Bush's logic for going into Iraq, we should also have invaded North Korea, a dictator-led regime which demonstrably did have nuclear weapons and did make a public display of them. What kept us from doing that?
That's a very nice question because it showed what kept us from doing it was a fear of being involved in conflicts that would get out of control.
With China?
Both with China, but even, you know, North Korea is a nuclear power too, and they were going to not retaliate against us necessarily. They're going to retaliate against the South.
Mm-hmm.
But also the fact is that we enter these conflicts very selectively. We enter them because, you know, one answer to the question, I'm sorry if it sounds cynical, is that there's nothing in Korea that's worth owning, in North Korea, that we have no interest in there other than a geopolitical interest. And we do tend to specialize in fighting in parts of the world where there's something that we want to control, some kind of resource that we want to control. But that's probably too cynical. I think that the reason that we don't go in to Korea or other places that also, you know, that might fall under the same places in Africa and so forth that you might also define in the same way, not as nuclear powers but as expansionist dictatorships and so on, is that there is a dawning sense, you know, on the part of the government that they are biting off more than they can chew. I mean, there's a dawning sense on their part that that they can't commit to indefinitely expanding wars everywhere without bankrupting the country. The Europeans are not going to go along with these kinds of adventures. They'll be criticized elsewhere. They don't want to revive the draft. They know that would be a total disaster for them to revive the draft. They're having trouble filling the ranks of the all-volunteer army now. there are limits to American power, even as powerful as we are. And that, incidentally, is one reason that the government has become interested in, they say, in conflict resolution. That is to say, they've been offering grant money and jobs and so forth to people in my field who they think will be able to help them resolve conflicts in places like Afghanistan, where military force is obviously not working in the way that some of the military dreamers, you know, hope that it would work. So they're saying to people in the conflict resolution field, why don't you come over to Afghanistan and help us settle some of these conflicts over there? And people have different sorts of responses to that kind of request. My own response is, no way. Am I going to practice conflict resolution under the gun? That I think if you mix, you know, we're a party to that conflict, and to pretend to be kind of impartial and to an impartial conflict resolver in that situation, it seems to me, is, you know, makes no sense. But the fact that they're talking that language of conflict resolution more and more and looking for this kind of help suggests to me that they are, that there is a growing recognition of what the limits of American power are in the world.
Do you think that's a factor more than anything of the reality that our allies aren't buying the justifications for war to the same extent that they had in the past?
I think that's true. You know, there is in some ways, progress does get made in the world, and one of the forms that it gets, one of the forms of progress is when people discover that there are ways other than violence to get what they need. The people who tend to discover this are the ones that have used a lot of it, or have, you know, that have gotten, have learned the lessons of the overuse of violence. The fact that since the Civil War, America has never had a war fought on its own soil, that we've only had a few of these attacks, as horrible as the attacks were at Pearl Harbor and in New York and Washington on September 11th, they're only a tiny taste of what a war on your own soil looks like. So when you see countries that have had that, that have gone through that, and whether in Europe or Japan or China or elsewhere, you know, the Russians lost 20 million people in World War II. The Chinese lost almost as many, at least 10 million. They have a different idea about what war means, and that is, there's some growing up that we have to do when it comes to that. Let's at least in our imaginations imagine what it would be like to have a war on our own soil and realize.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. Richard E. Rubenstein is professor of conflict resolution and public affairs at George Mason University. His new book is Reasons to Kill, Why Americans Choose War. Rich, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.